Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Black Lives Matter, chant the protesters in Ferguson, Missouri, and on Staten Island and around the country, objecting to the deaths of two unarmed black men by white cops. Of course, black lives matter. All lives should. But the Ferguson and Staten Island protests are actually asking us a bigger question. Do blacks and whites have a radically different experience of America in getting a job or hailing a cab or walking down the street with their families? Or is this more about class than it is about race? Our president has asked for a national conversation on race. Today we'll try. This hour, On Point, what we talk about when we talk about race. You can join the conversation on air or online. What grade would you give America on its ability to talk about race these days? Is the conversation too politically correct? Is it too loaded? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Today we're going to try to do something that we acknowledge is difficult, and that is to have a civilized conversation about race in America with three smart people who have three different opinions on this. Joining me first from Washington is Paul Butler. He is professor of law at Georgetown University. He's a former federal prosecutor at the Justice Department, a frequent contributor to the New York Times Room for Debate section, and author of Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice. Paul Butler, welcome to On Point.
Hey, John. Great to be here.
And also joining me from New York is John McWhorter. He's professor of linguistics and English at Columbia University. He's a contributor to Time magazine, author of a lot of books, including Authentically Black and Winning the Race Beyond the Crisis in Black America. John McWhorter, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And also from New York, Heather McDonald is joining us. She's a fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a contributing editor at City Journal. She's author of Are Cops Racist? How the War Against the Police Harms Black Americans. Heather McDonald, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me on, John. I appreciate it.
And where I'd like to start is I want to listen to something that our president said about trying to have this conversation. The trick here is that it is not our current president.
Over the coming year, I want to lead the American people in a great and unprecedented conversation about race. We have talked at each other and about each other for a long time. It's high time we all began talking with each other.
Bill Clinton in 1997, 17 years ago, saying it was high time. That's one bookend of the conversation. The other bookend I want to point out, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which is the hometown newspaper for Ferguson, Missouri, yesterday making an unusual decision. They've made this decision. They said, first of all, in an editorial, we challenged our region to have the serious discussion on race that it has been avoiding for decades. But in order to facilitate that conversation, they said this: we are going to turn off the comments in the editorial section for a while and see what we learn from it. And that is because of their experience in attempting to have this conversation on race through its editorial pages. The conversation so quickly turned so toxic, uncivil, and useless that they feel that it might work better to turn off the comments. Obviously, having this conversation is a challenge, and particularly the last few weeks have shown it. I want to start with you, Paul Butler. How, for you personally, how have the past few weeks, by which I'm referring to the grand jury decisions in the two cities we're talking about, Ferguson and New York City on Staten Island, how has the conversation changed for you in the last few weeks as a result of these incidents?
Well, I was disappointed in both decisions. I thought that the grand jury should have indicted in Ferguson, based on my experience as a former prosecutor. You know, the standard is so low, and typically grand jurors do what the prosecutor asks them to do. And given this prosecutor's record, I wasn't surprised, but I was still disappointed. In Garner, in Staten Island in New York, that's an easier case, and so I was especially disappointed there. So when I've reflected on the slogan that's come from the protest, Black Lives Matter, the fact that we still have to make that point in 2014 with an African-American president is very disappointing.
And it tells you what about the state of the conversation?
That we haven't come as far as we'd hoped. I remember the night that President Obama was first elected, and African Americans literally cheering in front of the White House, people of all races dancing in the street in Harlem. There was a sense that we'd been through a mighty struggle, but it meant something now that the country had elected the son of a man from Africa and a white woman from Kansas. And, you know, now the images, I think, going out of the Obama presidency will be African-Americans getting hosed in the streets of Ferguson or having dogs or tanks, just like something out of Mississippi in the 1960s.
Heather McDonald, I want to ask you basically the same question. Looking at the past few weeks, you write a lot about this, and you write a lot about the nature and the state of the conversation over race, and it's not just recently you've been doing that. How do you feel the last 2 weeks for you has changed the conversation?
Not much. I think we're still in our pre-existing positions. I totally agree with Professor Butler that Black Lives Matter, and I think that our public policy for the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years in this country has been dedicated to that proposition. We are desperately trying to bring up Black academic achievement, which continues to lag so far behind that you have not equal representation in universities, and policing has gone from a position when it really did not believe that Black lives matter and ignored crime in minority neighborhoods to now holding itself ruthlessly accountable for crime drops. I think that the Garner case was clearly a tragedy and an aberration in New York policing. It is not the norm. But I would disagree with Professor Butler's characterization of Ferguson as somehow comparable to the horrible, vile racism of the Deep South. What you had there was riots, people destroying the livelihoods of innocent shop owners and their employees. That was an insult and a assault on the rule of law that cannot be tolerated. The facts around the Brown shooting have been usually repressed by the media. So I would say the Brown is a much more difficult and compromised case, but I don't agree that this is a country that does not take Black lives very seriously.
All right. So I just want to give John McWhorter a chance to come into the conversation, but pointing out that we're already really seeing a difference in just interpretation of the meaning of the facts. But John McWhorter, you're a professor of linguistics at English at Columbia University. And in terms of us wanting to talk about communication, perhaps you're particularly well-credentialed to assist the notion of dissecting this conversation. How has it changed for you personally?
Well, language is only part of it. I mean, with all due respect to Professor Butler, it is significant that we have elected a Black president not just once but twice. We are a very different place than we were 50 years ago. And as I've often said, you don't go to where a house has burned down and left nothing but the chimney and say that the house hasn't burned down. However, the chimney is there, and the chimney is the relationship between the police and Black men, particularly young Black men. That is a genuine problem. It is the main reason that many people feel that America has not made any significant progress on race. It's the main reason that many Black people feel that they're not at home in their own country, and we do need to fix it. But now here's a language part. This idea that we need to have a conversation about it, and again, with all due and sincere respect to people who use the term, is a fiction, and it's kind of a linguistic trick, because what we're looking for is not a conversation, because after all, aren't we having one? Isn't there something about race that makes national headlines every single month? We have conversations
about
race all the time. But what we really mean is conversion. The idea is that what we're looking for is for all white people to agree with what all Black people think. Nobody says it, but that's what people must mean, given that we have the conversation all the time. And my point is, we don't need a conversation, because as we've seen with what happened with the St. Louis newspaper, it doesn't work. We've gotten about as far as we're going to go with that. It didn't work under President Clinton. What we need is not for people to realize that racism is a problem, which it is. We need to start thinking about how Black people can triumph over racism. That's what the conversation should be about. And to say that it's not possible is extremely pessimistic, not to mention dismissive of Black abilities and achievement.
John McQuarrie, let me take your point back to Paul Butler, where your point being that the demand is not really for a conversation, but I think you're saying that the demand is for agreement with the African American position, conversion.
Not overtly, but that's what
mean. Since what I want to talk about is the state of the conversation, I'd like to see what Paul Butler has to say about that, that it's not really about exchanging ideas because we're doing that.
Well, I think it's right that certainly race comes up a lot in the media and in conversations among people of the same race or like-minded people. And I also agree with John that most African Americans don't want a conversation. They want meaningful change. Mm. So, you know, there's studies that show that when Blacks apply to rent apartments or for mortgages or for jobs, they have a very different experience than whites, and they encounter discrimination. Even if you send out resumes and the names sound Black, you don't get the same return calls from employers as when the names sound white. So I think it's correct that African Americans don't care really about what people say. We're much more concerned about what people do. So I think the concern is ending the kind of discrimination that unfortunately is still a major barrier to the achievement of people of color.
Heather McDonald, I can only give you about 30 seconds before we go to a break, and maybe you can start your thought and come back to it when we return from the break. But it's an interesting thing for me to hear your co-panelist saying it's actually not about the quality of the conversation. Do you agree with that? Because I know that the nature of the conversation has been something that has disturbed you.
Well, I think that Mr. McWhorter's perception of conversion is an accurate one, but I do think that there are important facts that have been left out the national discourse about race.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're trying to and are succeeding at having a conversation about race in America after Ferguson, Staten Island, and beyond. And what we're talking about is what we're talking about. It's a conversation about the conversation. We want to look a little bit at the notion of the quality of the arguments made on both sides and get into the whole question of whether there's a common vocabulary. I'm joined by John McWhorter of Columbia University and Paul Butler of Georgetown and Heather McDonald of the Manhattan Institute. And Heather, you are halfway through addressing the whole notion about the quality of the conversation and to a degree about how it's framed. So why don't you continue with that thought?
Well, I can give you a specific example, John. UCLA, the University of California at Los Angeles, has gone through a series of accusations recently that the university is profoundly racist. A student-made video went viral called The Black Bruins that complained about the fact that Black males are only 3.3% of the UCLA population. This triggered a virtually unanimous agreement, even on the part of the university administration that profusely apologized for this. The facts that were left out of that viral video and the ensuing debate was that Black students in California lag radically behind whites and Asians. Their truancy rates are 4 times higher than the state average. Their 8th grade reading rates are only 11% proficiency among Blacks compared to 61% proficiency among Asians. Those types of starting disparities, which is where we should be concentrating, are usually left out of the conversation.
May I ask Heather, just to interrupt and tell me if I'm interrupting you to the wrong point. But I'm curious to know, when you say that the facts were left out, are you saying they're left out due to a political motivation or a propaganda purpose?
I think people don't want to look at the facts, and I think there is a commitment certainly in the university setting that spreads out, to the idea that racism remains the primary barrier to Black equal outcomes at this point. And pointing out decisions that individuals make, behavioral differences, is pretty much taboo in many environments. That is also the case with criminal justice discussions. It is a received wisdom that the criminal justice system is racist. What is usually left out of that discussion is the fact that young black males between the ages of 14 and 17, for example, commit homicide at nearly 10 times the rate of white and Hispanic young males of those ages combined. So we have a tendency to look at the final point in our social systems without looking at why that may have been the case and the behaviors that led to that point.
John McWhorter, I mean, what we're hearing Heather McDonald say is detrimental to communication and conversation is a suppression of certain parts of the conversation. That there, she's mm-hmm. arguing there are certain things that are not allowed to be brought up or talked about. Do I think she didn't use the term, but due to political correctness. Is there anything to that, do you think?
Oh, well, yeah, but I think it goes further than that. And I was minted in that exact atmosphere because I was teaching at UC Berkeley when there were very similar discussions going on 15 years ago. And I think what it comes down to is not simply that things are suppressed as if there's some sort of malicious intent. What it is something almost sadder. People think, and I think black people have brought into it, and certainly white fellow travelers believe, that descendants of African slaves are the first human beings on the history of the planet, and I do mean this, who cannot triumph over obstacles. So the idea is, of course, these students can't perform at the level that white and Asian students do, or to extend it to the law, of course, these people are going to break laws because they can't help it because there's institutional racism and there's white privilege. Now, I know that when people say that, they feel like they're being compassionate. I think when black people buy into it, they feel like they're espousing a higher wisdom and even a kind of pride. But the truth is, no one has demonstrated to me that institutional racism and white privilege are insuperable obstacles. And that notion is a very new kind of enlightenment that is very local to our particular supposedly enlightened times. And it's very dangerous because it leaves a holding pattern, which we end up calling a conversation not happening as we are now.
Well, let me bring in a couple more data points from the culture. I want to listen to something that we heard from a protester named Chenier in Oakland. This was after the Missouri grand jury decided not to indict the police officer who killed Michael Brown. And she discussed what she thought was really at play, not just there, but also in her own community, Oakland.
There has been a collective assault through education, through housing, through transportation, through access to wealth, through police murders. There is an intensive and intentional war on black people in this country.
And then on the other hand, we have Bill O'Reilly on his Fox News show discussing, in a sense, the mirror image through the mirror of this portrayal of what's going on in America.
The race hustlers blame white privilege, an unfair society, a terrible country. So the message is, it's not your fault if you abandon your children, if you become a substance abuser, if you are a criminal. No, it's not your fault, it's society's fault.
Paul Butler, we heard Bill O'Reilly use the term white privilege. John McWhorter has brought it up as well. Vocabulary which perhaps one side coined in an effort to communicate a concept, and it's rejected. I want to talk a little bit about that coinage and essentially what it means to you and, to in your eyes, its validity as part of the conversation.
So if you think about the history of African Americans in the United States, we came in as slaves, and then there was this rampant violent discrimination in both private action and in the law. And in recent history, maybe the last 50 years since the passage of the Civil Rights Act, it's been illegal, but study after study shows that African Americans still encounter discrimination. And so if I'm trying to get a taxi in a very kind of benign example, it's more difficult for me than it is for a white person. Last time I saw you in person was at a debate about the legalization of drugs, and we talked then about the fact that blacks don't use drugs more than anybody else, about 13% of folks who use drugs, but 60% of folks who are locked up for drug crimes. So that's a privilege that whites have, less attention from the police, more attention from employers, even more attention from doctors when folks go for health care. So it's this privilege to be immune from certain kinds of discrimination that African Americans suffer. Not saying that every white person has it all good, because we know clearly that's not true, and poor white folks don't have it great. Gays and lesbians who are white have different experiences than straight. So all it is an observation that there are certain benefits that attach to being white in our country.
Do you think the term, since it's a flashpoint that, I mean, you've just been explaining it, and it's not this and it's not that, that it comes so loaded to some white ears that it's one that should be dropped from the conversation? Or do you consider it continues to be useful and needs,
John,
a little bit of glossing?
Sure. You know, John, the thing is, I don't hear a lot of African-Americans talking about white privilege. Mm-hmm. So when I hear Bill O'Reilly or Heather make those kinds of comments, I think that they probably haven't spent a lot of time in black churches, where you certainly get these messages that the way to achieve is to not focus on discrimination. President Obama, they must not listen to a lot of his speeches. He gave a talk at Morehouse College, the preeminent university for African-American men, and he said, nobody cares how much discrimination you suffered. No more excuses. You have to achieve in spite of all that. That's the message that African-American children get.
But, Paul, if I may, I think you and I both know, however, that our intellectual class, as well as most of our activist class, hate it when Barack Obama strikes that tone. And they often think of what those ministers are saying as what's often scornfully called the politics of black respectability. And so I think black people get conflicting messages there. You're right. It's very easy when we're at our barbecues, et cetera, for somebody to say we've got to take care of ourselves. But they're people, and we both know their names, who consider that to be a backwards way of thought. And they think that Uncle Buster needs to understand the notion of white privilege, right?
Well, I think that, you know, African Americans, like everybody else, are sophisticated thinkers. So they can understand that there are some ways that black people can achieve and need to achieve despite entrenched discrimination. And at the same time, understand that it's okay to talk about that discrimination and fight against it. And so I think that's what's going on in Ferguson and in Staten Island.
Well,
Heather, join in, please. What I wanted to ask you to do, and again, you can pursue the point that you wanted to make, but I want to move on from this question of white privilege, but to hear your take on it, as it is a flashpoint, whether you think it's a useful and meaningful term or not.
Well, first of all, I would just say that the Oakland protester who claimed that there was an intentional war on black people is not a particularly sophisticated thinker, but she has received very clear messages in the culture that are leading her to that view, and I think that's a wrong view, but it's also a dangerous one because it leads people to not take advantage of the opportunities that are available to them. White privilege, I don't think is also a particularly useful idea. One is always compelled in these discussions to say, of course, racism exists. There's also black racism against whites that exist. But at this point, I think that the contributions of white anti-black racism to black outcomes are less significant than personal responsibility decisions that people can make. And I think the country is in denial about the problems of the underclass, whether it's black or white, the breakdown of the family. I applaud every time President Obama has spoken to the fact that children need their fathers. Until we can get more poor children, black and white, raised by their fathers, you're going to have the same disparities that are then looked at the academy and blamed on white racism. And there's not a whole lot of things that other people can do to persuade people to raise their children and to say they have that personal responsibility there.
And let's bring in Cheryl from Providence, Rhode Island. Cheryl, welcome to On Point.
Oh, hi, John. Thank you for taking my call.
It's a pleasure.
I was calling because I think I probably am not part of the so-called underclass, but I definitely don't come from a privileged background in any way. But I do have, I'm an Ivy Leaguer, I have a PhD, I have other members of my family who are also PhDs. But I wanted to say that I really want to get the point across that there are these differences. I'm African-American, and there are those differences, some small, some big, in everyday life with the police, but also in many other facets of everyday life. And I think that's something that is not really very much acknowledged in this country. Sometimes I just feel like I have to give more of an explanation. For instance, if I talk about my cousin, who I'm very a younger cousin that I'm very proud of, who has seven children, mm-hmm. and then I feel like I have to say, but he's an engineer and he's married to one woman and he takes care of his children, but they have chosen to have seven children. And I think that if I say that without providing that background, the assumptions always thought that somehow this is a very irresponsible person and not a good father. So I just wanted to really make that point.
So,
there are all these differences, and I don't think they're addressed. Thank you.
I think I agree.
Thanks,
with Cheryl, and I'm sure that her experience is accurate and representative. The fact is people do make generalizations, and the reason that those generalizations are out there, which can feel extraordinarily unfair when they're applied to you they're not relevant, is because there is an underclass problem. You have 73% of black children now being born out of wedlock. You have a crime rate that among young black males, the homicide rate is 10 times that of whites and Hispanics combined. In New York City, blacks commit nearly 80% of all shootings, though they're only 23% of the population. Blacks and Hispanics commit over 98% of all shootings in New York. Whites commit 2%, though they're 35%. Until those underlying facts change, there are going to be people who thoughtlessly or as purely a inevitable fact of human thinking make generalizations. So, yes, let's fight against the generalizations. But, again, I think we're not paying enough attention to the fact that those snap judgments are arising out of a reality that needs to change.
Paul Butler, your
John,
response to that?
Sure.
Like
so that reality is created by structural discrimination. So if you look at the average net worth of an African-American woman who, Heather's right, is probably raising black kids, it's $100 compared to a white man, $41,000. So if you think that difference in wealth doesn't matter in terms of the kinds of opportunities that children have to grow up in healthy households where they're exposed to great schools, everybody knows that matters. So when we think about ways to move forward, how to make a difference, we've got to talk about that structural discrimination, about the fact that the reason that whites have a kind of wealth that most African Americans don't is because most of that comes through housing, and black people weren't allowed to receive the same kinds of housing benefits, starting with the GI Bill, starting with Social Security. So there's just been this historical discrimination that plays a role now. So no one's talking about Ku Klux Klansmen. That's not my experience. I don't run into white people every day, really any, who I think are racist. I think that people may hold stereotypes about me that, they need to get over. But the problem isn't, again, the Klan now. The problem is this more insidious kind of discrimination based on structures that we can do something about.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and you can join this conversation. What are the solutions, something we'd like to look to, and I mean the solution to being able to talk to each other about this? I'm joined by Paul Butler of Georgetown, Heather McDonald of the Manhattan Institute, and John McWhorter of Columbia University. Just pointing out in the news relevant to our topic, the Attorney General announcing new guidelines for federal law enforcement agencies. This came this week, restricting those organizations, actually banning them from profiling on the basis of religion, national origin, gender, gender identity, or sexual orientation. And that's an update in that policy. We're also hearing from many of you by Twitter. I'll read a few of the comments we're hearing. Number one, what we need is a change in economics. Poverty is the underlying commonality of the barriers. Here's a second one. What are the challenges and institutional barriers that push this demographic towards criminal habits? Here's a third one. You can work towards change and still have a conversation. Both are necessary for a stronger America. We're attempting to have that conversation, and I want to go to John McWhorter. John, just before the break, we were talking and responding, both you and Paul were responding to Heather McDonald, talking about certain lists of facts relevant to struggles that reveal struggles in the African American community by and large, not everybody. Paul Butler was talking about the causes of those facts, underlying causes, and you are going to have your chance to respond now.
What happened between Cheryl, Paul, and Heather actually perfectly illustrated what our problem is. I mean, Paul basically gave a very articulate view that you could kind of call the MSNBC view. Heather gave a very articulate and factual account of what you could call the Fox News view. And there's your conversation. And let's face it, it stops there. It's a stalemate. There's not going to be any significant degree of agreement
between
those two views.
What do we do about that, John?
But this is what I wanted to say. Cheryl, if I may, the whole idea of saying that we need white people, and this is what I mean, John, white people to acknowledge the facts that you were talking about is a very new way of viewing things. I think that a more productive kind of black pride is one which has nothing to do with obsessing over how white people feel and whether or not they acknowledge. Our job is to do. And so I certainly can imagine that white people don't acknowledge the facts about that relative, and I don't think that they ever will. But my question is, why is it necessary that they do? Our job is to do for ourselves, not to think about other people's psychology.
Paul Butler, what is your take on that?
Well, again, I just don't think anyone, especially African-American people, contest the fact that the way to achieve in the United States is through hard work, through personal responsibility, through good morals, treating other people the way that you want to be treated. And the vast majority of African Americans live their lives just like that. They're as hardworking as anybody else.
Let me just interrupt for a second because I think you've actually made that point a few times, and I felt that John was turning the conversation in a slightly different direction, which is to say that the part of the conversation that comes down to the African American community wanting the white community in the conversation to concede their point is a non-starter. He was more or less saying, forget about it. I found that an interesting take on it. That's what I was asking.
Well, again, as African-Americans don't spend a lot of time wishing that white folks would agree with us. Mm-hmm. African-Americans spend a lot of time thinking, gee, it'd be nice when I go to the doctor with a bad headache and he doesn't give me an MRI if I have to wonder if it's because I'm black. It'd be nice if when I apply for a mortgage that the fact that I'm African-American is not the reason that I don't get it. So, again, I don't think black folks are interested in a discourse about discourse. They're interested in getting rid of this great rock on our back. That means that we don't have the same access to the American dream as white folks.
Let me bring in some callers. John, Cyrus is calling in from Austin, Texas. Cyrus, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Thanks a lot. I think Mr. Butler put his finger right on it. When we talk about racism, the definition is important. I wish everyone who thinks racism's over would understand this point. You don't need any racists to have a racist society. We need to understand, you know, this concept of institutional racism, and the truth is in the statistics, and you've heard some of them today. When the entire group of parents or grandparents of a particular population didn't have access to mortgages or education, the likelihood for an inheritance if you're black is a tiny fraction of that of an average white person. If you get an inheritance, the size is a fifth the size of whether if you're black, you're much more likely to be living in poverty. And it shouldn't be a surprise when, you know, those people's grandparents and great-grandparents were traded like cattle. So the history is why we have difference in average net worth, why mothers are working two jobs. And to talk about racism as if these are not also, you know, a part of the conversation and there's some other conversation about personal responsibility is silly. I want to make just two really quick points also. One of the aspects of white privilege or just privilege in general is not knowing that you're privileged. It's like asking a fish, you know, how's the water? And the fish says, what water? And also, you know, there are experts in these issues. And if you want to help the situation, pick up an anthropology book. The Hidden Cost of Being African American is a good one. American Apartheid, Segregation, and the Making of the Underclass is another good one. Read those books before, you know, having
opinions. All right, Cyrus, thanks for your call. I just want to let some of our panelists respond. Heather McDonald, what do you make of Cyrus's comments just now? What do you make of what he said?
Well, I think the phrase institutional racism, which is pervasive in certainly in academic environments, is a telling one because we have moved to try and preserve the principle of racism as the main way of explaining black outcomes today, having acknowledged that there aren't very many instances of overt racism. Thank heavens we've moved beyond that horrible, ugly period of American life in an enormous way. And we're still, nevertheless, convinced that there are somehow built-in forces of racism, even though we can't necessarily point to the causes. And I think that's, again, a way of changing the topic from where it should be. Professor Butler says that blacks don't spend a lot of time wishing that white folks would agree with them. At least in the university setting, there are constant demands, constant judgments against the university for being racist because there aren't sufficient blacks in a university population.
Paul Butler,
kids are not studying.
Heather, let me, because time is limited, I just find it interesting that you bring that point out of the university, and I'm interrupting to ask Paul, who's also in a university setting, to respond to that perception that Heather has written about a lot, that in the university setting, the notion of institutional racism, of white privilege, is very much the dominant discourse, and that it's impossible nearly impossible for people to argue against it. You're in a university as well at Georgetown. Do you see that? Is that for real?
I'm privileged to teach at a school with a robust, creative set of students and faculty, and so folks are all over the place on these issues. There is a concern at Georgetown, like at UCLA, that the number of African-American students has actually been reduced in recent years. That's what the subject of the complaint was and the video that went viral at UCLA was. And so, you know, for a while, there was actually, because of affirmative action, one of the most successful racial justice programs we've had, a critical mass of African-American students at these elite institutions. They graduated and they did great. According to some statistics, they actually made more money than their white counterparts. But then folks like Heather started agitating against these programs, and now there are fewer. So there's been a reduction in black students. So that's the concern that I hear among college students in the university.
Let me come back to Heather. But Heather, you're talking about the nature of being able to speak freely about the topic, though, are you not?
Right, that there is a certain set of facts which are not just not allowed. And if I can just speak to the specifics, UCLA continues to admit blacks at twice the rate as would be explained by their academic qualifications and socioeconomic levels. So despite the ban on racial preferences, the school is twisting itself into knots to admit as many black students as it can. To pretend that this is somehow a racist institution is preposterous. What you need to look at is what's happening in schools. Are students doing their homework? Are they showing up to school? Are they taking their textbooks home? We are not willing to speak about the problems at lower levels, and a lot of these have to do with academic motivation. The very student who made the viral Black Bruins video admitted in an MSNBC subsequent interview that there isn't enough emphasis on academic achievement. Obviously, there are people that are sending that message, but I just disagree with Professor Butler quite respectfully that the focus of discourse is on personal responsibility as opposed to saying that white society is to blame for the lagging achievement in certain groups of blacks. There's people who are succeeding magnificently.
John McWhorter, also, you're at Columbia University. Is the conversation as suppressed as there, as Heather McDonald is suggesting she's seeing as an observer, outside observer at UCLA?
You know, in the time I've been at Columbia, there has not been a particular flare-up about the affirmative action issue, and so I can't say. But I would have to say that in terms of the previous exchange, I would have to go with Heather that, of course, black people talk about personal responsibility, but the understanding is that you don't want to talk about it too much because what Cyrus was talking about is considered to be more important. And what worries me is that if you know, white privilege, yes, that is very much there. But if what we mean by that is that black America's problems are going to stay the same until there's no white privilege, then unfortunately, what you're saying is that nothing is going to happen, and I can't use that. I think that black America can succeed even in a deeply imperfect society, and I wish somebody would tell me why that's not true.
Okay. And let's go to Corgi calling in from Springfield, Ohio. Hello, Corgi. You're on point. Welcome.
Hi, John. I just want to make propose a radical proposition on how we can advance this conversation. I really feel that the conversation here in America really can't advance because all of us in society can't agree on a common context on which to advance this conversation. You know, the theme of the conversation is Black Lives Matter. But if you are not black, if you are not African American, then when you look at when you hear that phrase, it seems to sound like the color of your skin makes your life matter. Or that if you are not black, then somehow your life does not matter. And then the people who want to be a part of the conversation who are not African American, they can only go by racial stereotypes because they're not familiar with the black experience. So I think that the conversation should not be under the banner of Black Lives Matter, but it should be that all human lives matter. And if we can create that as a basic context, then everybody in America becomes a stakeholder in the conversation, and that we don't have to worry, we don't have to say to ourselves, well, that's just a black kid, and I'm not black, so I don't have to worry about it. But that we can look at all these people in Missouri or in New York or wherever these events are happening as that's my son or daughter that is being affected here. That is my son's or daughter's life, and I should care about how that life has been affected by this event.
Thank you, Corgi. Paul Butler sends... idealistic there. Too idealistic or realistic, do you think?
Oh, I'm pretty idealistic, too. So I agree with what you said at the introduction of the program, John, that John from Columbia and Heather from the Manhattan Institute are super smart, creative people. And I also think that they're concerned about racial justice. So I don't think we're going to agree on everything, but I certainly think that there are things we could work on together that would advance the cause of African Americans. The concern I have about what the caller said is, again, because we're scholars, we know that we have to deal with reality. So unfortunately, in this country, race matters. So African Americans have a different kind of experience than non-African Americans. And, you know, we can think about why that is all day. But what I'm more interested in working with John and Heather on is looking again at these structures like criminal justice, like healthcare, like education, to think about ways to improve their outcomes.
John McWhorter, what would you need to realize what Paul Butler just outlined as a sort of common ground, a sort of let's move forward? Who needs to change, if anybody?
Well, you know what? That's exactly it. I don't think that anybody needs to change in the sense that we're going to change our ways of perceiving the world or our sense of what justice is, because I think that that happened to the extent that it's going to roughly in 1964 and then into the early 70s. What we need to do is have a new paradigm where we say that, no, life isn't fair. There is white privilege. But here are the things we can do. And for me, that's the end of the war on drugs. That's a whole other topic. Well, here are the things we can do to make black lives better. Now, to the extent that we have to understand that black lives, like all other lives, matter to care about that, sure. But please don't tell me that we need to end white privilege before we can do anything real about black America, because that is a racist position.
Heather McDonald, same question to you. What needs to change to move this conversation forward?
Well, I think we have to realize that people are in good faith, by and large, that they are wanting to help more blacks achieve the American dream. And if people believe that there's significant white racism and that that will matter, if you can eradicate that, they've certainly been working on that for years. I would just ask for an equal acknowledgement that black lives do matter, and that means that kids need fathers, and the crime rate in the inner city, which is mowing down black lives at stupendous rates and killing innocent black children, that the focus has to be there, and that, in fact, American society is focused on that in their police practices, and nobody is discounting black lives.
All right. We have to wrap it up there, but I just want to say that I want to thank all three of our panelists who obviously disagree. This is not easy stuff, but all that I heard in terms of your conversations with one another was respect and a fair amount of goodwill. So congratulations and thanks. John McWhorter, linguist and professor at Columbia University, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Heather McDonald, fellow at the Manhattan Institute and contributing editor at City Journal, thank you.
Thank you, John.
And Paul Butler, former prosecutor and professor at Georgetown Law School. Thank you, Paul.
Great to be here, John.
You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, the explosive Senate torture report on harsh interrogation techniques years in the making is coming out. It's graphic, controversial. I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.